This is Functional Medicine Update for October 2005, Volume 25, Number 10. The theme of this month's edition is titled Through the Barriers, a look at the knowledge we now have about the gastrointestinal system. Our reports will include Dr. Sidney Baker's contribution to our knowledge of membrane tissue defense barriers and pathology, epithelial structure function and energy, defense dynamics in the gut, alterations in gut barrier function including inflammation, renewal of the gut mucosa, bacterial activity in the gut, and restoring gut bacterial balance. This month's interview is with Dr. Kenneth Fine, discussing the subject of diarrhea and the normalization of GI function. We'll complete this month's edition with a look at food sensitivities in the gut and maintaining the epithelial immune balance. Now, here is Dr. Jeffrey Bland.
Welcome to Functional Medicine Update for October 2005. As you undoubtedly know, we're looking forward to the 2006 13th International Symposium on Functional Medicine, and this is the time to get us prepared for that. It's going to be on detoxification in the area of functional medicine, and as you know, the topic of detoxification has so many aspects to it that I thought it might be useful to spend a few months' worth of functional medicine update issues to develop the preliminary information that underpins detoxification. And so the April 19th through April 22nd, 2006, 13th International Symposium on Detoxification and Biotransformation, which, by the way, will be held at the Tampa Marriott Waterfront Resort, beautiful five-star resort in Tampa, will focus on various aspects of the detoxification biotransformation story. And the part of it that I wanted to start with in this issue of our October issue of Functional Medicine Update has to do with what I call functional medicine at the barriers. Some of you might think this is a fairly esoteric topic. How do barriers of defense relate to detoxification and toxicity? But hopefully by the end of this month's Functional Medicine Update edition, you'll see that this plays a principal first level of regulation and actually defense against potential toxic exposure. And the barriers we're talking about are the epithelial barriers, and there's probably no one that has described these barriers better than our own master teacher, Dr. Sidney Baker, who in his lectures, writings, and books has spoken so eloquently about barriers of defense, the mucosal surfaces, the fact that we're enfolded and protected, wrapped, cloaked against the exposure both internally and externally to potential toxins as a consequence of these membranous barriers. As he's pointed out, the gastrointestinal mucosal barrier, for instance, when laid out flat and stretched tight so that the villi are all lying flat, would occupy an area about equivalent to a singles tennis court. So we have this very large membranous barrier that defends us and is involved with selective permeability by active transport, so pulling the good things in and rejecting the bad things. And these barriers of defense play very important roles in maintaining health against a hostile environment. As we know, the membranes are not just that of our mucosal surfaces. They also include the enfolding of membranes within every cell. It could be the endoplasmic reticular membrane or the cellular membrane or the nuclear envelope membrane or the membrane that surrounds the mitochondria. So we basically are not this baggie of cellular soup that just washes about, but rather all these metabolic and physiological processes occur on the surfaces of specific topological structures that we call membranes. And these membranes become both the barriers and an active part of our cellular organelle systems. So both on a gross level, the epithelial level, and on a cellular level, the membranous level, we think barriers of defense play a very important role as a fundamental principle in functional health. And of course, in functional medicine, within our Applied Functional Medicine and Clinical Practice Training Program, we spend quite a bit of time talking about the basic core principles that differentiate a functional medicine approach towards the lens of viewing a patient from that of the histopathology or the differential diagnostic traditional methodology, which is more looking at the endpoints of a process of loss of function arriving at some determined or agreed upon point of pathology. Well before that, however, are signs and various biochemical changes that occur that reflect changing function. And one of those principal early stage changes is in these barriers of defense, leading to breakdown or loss of selective transport or active transport, which then influences, like a dog chasing its tail, the function of the cell, tissue, organ system until it eventually can weave its way downstream into a pathology. So the discussion of barriers of defense within physiological systems and how they play a role in protecting against exposure to injurious substances, be it either endogenously or exogenously produced or delivered, and also the active role of these membranous surfaces to pull in what is necessary from the outside world by active transport and leaving behind that which is not, or getting rid of things from the inside of the cell or inside of the body that are not necessary. This would be the excretory processes of membranous surfaces. All of these become a dynamic and important part of understanding functional physiology. And it's with that in mind that we're going to be focusing our attention this month on these epithelial barriers in human health and disease. Now, I apologize because some of what I'm going to be saying undoubtedly will be review and maybe repetition for many of you who are well inculcated within the functional medicine model. But I believe it's important to set the ground rules for all of us as we move forward into our clinician of the month this month. So let's just start with some basic principles. First of all, as you know, the tissue level barriers have physiological function. They're not just barriers like dams. They have dynamic function, and we actually see these epithelial barriers and membranous barriers as being parts of our organ systems involved with the homeodynamic processing of environmental information. Barriers not only separate fluids, but they also have very important work that they do by resorbing solutes from different compartments or secreting substances or transporting things. So in so doing, they establish gradients across them. And these gradients are maintained as a consequence of energy processes, because whenever you have a high concentration of something on one side and a low concentration on the other, that's a semipermeable membrane. And in order to maintain that concentration gradient, work has to be done, metabolic work, which then requires energy. And that energy comes from the same source of biochemical energy that all other processes in cells derive their energy from, which are the high energy reduced cofactors or intermediates like adenosine triphosphate, ATP, or NADPH, or FADH2, NADH. These are particular high energy molecules that are really formed as a consequence of aerobic metabolism, mitochondrial oxidative phosphorylation. So there's a connection between biochemical energetics and membrane function that I think is important to keep in mind, because concentration gradients that are maintained by membranes require then energy process, which then ties itself back to oxidative chemistry, to mitochondrial oxidative phosphorylation, which is glycolysis, aminolysis, lipolysis, the things that we've discussed in intermediary metabolism. These gradients are then used to establish other gradients, and for instance, you think about the sodium gradient or the potassium gradient or things related to uric acid or things related to albumin. All of these concentrations are maintained through proper membranous function and structure. What constitutes a barrier? Well, an epithelial barrier or even an endothelial barrier that lines the surface of our vasculature, that one cell thick lining, has several elements related to its barrier function. There are luminal secretions such as mucus or unstirred layers on top of the apical cells. And there are the epithelial or endothelial cell per se, which then maintains things like various messenger molecule sensitivity, because there are proteins bound or embedded within the epithelial barriers or the endothelial barriers, which are receptor sites, and they pick up messages, and therefore they transmit messages from outside the cell to inside the cell through these receptor signal transduction processes. So the point I'm trying to emphasize is that we shouldn't think of the epithelial barrier as being static and being just a structure like collagen. We should think of it as a dynamic fluid mosaic model that is aggregating and disaggregating, changing its personality in real time, binding certain messenger molecules, transmitting those to the interior of the cell, and altering the phenotype of cells based upon the environmental signals that are picked up on these membrane receptor surfaces. So if we then ask, relative to the gut epithelial barrier, what do we know about its function? Well, we know that, as Dr. Baker has said, how do you like to spend your life with all that doo-doo and vomit surrounding you? That's a very graphic description of an epithelial cell in the gastrointestinal tract. So there's a lot of dynamic function that's going on with gastrointestinal epithelium, a high turnover rate. These cells are in a very caustic environment. Its pH has changed. As you know, it can be very acid. There can be all these microbiological critters that are proliferating that then produce their own irritant chemicals for which the epithelium has to respond. Again, it has to maintain its integrity. If it doesn't, the epithelial barrier breaks down. Its intercellular junctions are compromised where one cell is bound to another through desmosomes. And we start seeing a breakdown of that intracellular junction, then what we get is a pericellular flux of material, sometimes called leaky gut syndrome, where larger molecular molecules that were previously excluded now become permeable to the gut and have access to the internal compartments across the barrier. And so these tight junctions, if they break down, can then lead to a pericellular flux. You can also get transcellular flux, where you actually get transport of substances directly across the epithelial cells themselves. This doesn't require breakdown of the tight junction, so this would be different than what we normally associate with leaky gut syndrome. Leaky gut would be more defined as breakdown of the tight junctions and the increase in pericellular flux by osmotic diffusion across the membrane, leading to basolateral membranous exposure to these substances that were previously excluded. So one thing that we know is that the gut environment is a home to many different types of microorganisms. Certain disease organisms seemed intent, obviously, on getting into the stromal or vascular fluid compartments from the luminal compartment, and one of the things that prevents that from happening is the epithelial barrier, this barrier defense. We also know that the epithelial barriers have immunological function, particularly in the gut, with the production of mucus and secretory IgA antibodies that then help to defend the gut mucosal barrier against potential injury due to opportunistic infection in the gut. And so when we start looking at this dynamic process, we recognize that gastrointestinal microorganisms can play an important role in modifying gut mucosal barrier function. And we could obviously think of microorganisms into three families. We could think of symbiotic bacteria that actually participate in immunological upregulation and have a trophic effect on gut immunity. Or we could think of commensal-related microorganisms that just find a friendly place there. They don't harm or hurt the host. And then lastly, of course, are the parasitic organisms, which can result in damage to the GI mucosal environment and the immunological system of the gut and produce a disease resulting in things like compromised intercellular junctions and pericellular flux and what we call leaky gut, which then liberates these larger molecular molecules through the mucosal barrier into the portal circulation, and now other parts of the body, principally the immune system, gets exposed to these substances, and now you get a downstream hepatobiliary effect, and then you get a systemic effect through immune cells, and then that's communicated to barriers at a distance like the blood-brain barrier, and so from that we can start seeing the emergence of conditions clinically like hepatic encephalopathy. As you probably know, we really should call that gastrointestinal hepatic encephalopathy because it's the gut connected to the liver, connected to the brain. So if there is a compromised GI function, breakdown of pericellular junctions, absorption of these potentially toxic molecules, they then are liberated to the liver. If the liver systems for managing those toxins is compromised or overwhelmed, then there is a relay system that sets these activities up into the systemic circulation ultimately, through either direct or indirect effects of the immune system on the blood-brain barrier. Now you start getting potential putative neurotransmitters or neurotoxins being delivered, or an upregulation of the immune system of the gut, which then leads to an upregulation of the immune system of the liver through the Kupffer cells, and ultimately an alteration of the immune system of the brain called the microglia. And now we have the potential of neuronal injury or a neuronal apoptosis or accelerated brain cell death as a consequence of exposure to these toxic molecules. And this in part has been given as the explanation why people that have gluten sensitivity to alpha-gliadin in grain proteins often go on to have higher incidence of dementia in early later age if they continue to eat wheat-based products, because the immunological activation that occurs through this cascade of gut mucosal breakdown, immune activation, hepatic Kupffer cell activation, systemic immune cell activation, and ultimately blood-brain barrier alteration and neuronal effects can constitute the pathogenesis of dementia in a person where the problem started as a gut-immune relationship with their food. Food for one is a poison for another, is the argument that comes out of this. So not everybody obviously has dementia from eating wheat, but those individuals who may have this unique connection between a gut messaging system and ultimately a brain neuronal activation through glial cell upregulation may be at risk. So when we start looking at this story from a functional medicine perspective, we have to look at it as a web. We can't look at each of the compartments in isolation. So we can't just say, what would the gastroenterologist say? And then what would the hepatologist say? And then what would the immunologist say? And then what would the neurologist say? It's really a part of a system of understanding of how these agents are connected together through these mechanisms. And it starts, obviously, by alterations in barrier function through immunological barrier changes and through defensive barrier changes, leading to the greater absorption of some of these potential immunological or toxic activating molecules. Now, as is clearly obvious, one of the clinical manifestations of microbial dysfunction in the gut is diarrhea. And actually, diarrhea illustrates how epithelial barrier dysfunction leads to disease pathology. As you know, diarrhea can be classified into two main types, an inflammatory and a non-inflammatory type of diarrhea. Inflammatory diarrhea relates to cell death, and it leads ultimately to blood present in the stool. Non-inflammatory diarrhea falls into two main categories, secretory and osmotic. Secretory diarrhea occurs when generally the small intestine, and to a lesser extent the large intestine, secretes large amounts of electrolytes and water in excess of their resorptive capacity. This is generally a consequence of what's called dilution as the solution to pollution, right? And so if you've got a toxic bacteria like Shigella that's producing funny metabolites, the body has the ability to try to dilute it by pulling water from the cells into the GI contents, so that's your diarrhea, right? It's dilution as the solution to pollution. Unfortunately, it pulls electrolytes with it, and if you're in a serious case of Shigatoxin, then eventually you can have electrolyte imbalances, dehydration, and in developing countries of the world, this can lead to infant death. In the severe case, it can be very compromising. Those of us with traveler's diarrhea can be very discomforting, at the least. So, secretory diarrhea is caused by these bacterial toxins and enteropathogenic viruses. Osmotic diarrhea occurs when solutes that are water-soluble and unabsorbable remain in the bowel and retain water, like with lactulose, for instance. It's often used to treat hepatic encephalopathy. You give a non-absorbable sugar, which then produces a hyperosmolar condition in the gut, and then it pulls a lot of water from the cells and creates diarrhea. As you probably recognize, eating a high-solute, low diet can do that in people that have absorptive problems and just overloads their absorptive capacity. So you can actually produce diarrhea in most any one of us if we drink enough salt or we eat enough high solute containing materials that are not easily absorbed. It will be basically causing this osmolar shock, which then causes dilution and then results in dilution and results in diarrhea. So the toxic form of diarrhea, as related to the release of various toxins from certain parasitic bacteria, could be enterotoxic E. coli, for instance, in the most serious kinds of cases. It produced years ago the hamburger crisis from the fast food chains, the H0157 E. coli. This is where a very serious toxin is produced that then leads to a breakdown, obviously, of gut mucosal function, stresses the liver, ultimately has a toxic effect on kidneys, and the cause of death often was renal failure in these children, unfortunately, that had the fatal outcome from exposure to this bacterium. So that's the inside, or maybe we should call it the outside edge of toxicity. Well before that, however, there are many bacteria that produce less serious conditions that we get more chronic problems from, things like Clostridia perfringens, enterotoxin, which causes increases in permeability and physically associates itself with the production of a variety of inflammatory proteins from the gut mucosa. Clostridium difficile is another one. The difficile organism is an anaerobe that causes antibiotic-associated diarrhea and colitis, and many people who are on long-term antibiotic therapy end up getting a population of this parasitic organism, the Clostridium difficile, which then associates itself with all these various toxic-related effects leading to GI mucosal breakdown, absorption of other molecular weight molecules from the gut, and hepatic and immune-related stress from a functional medicine perspective. In infants, we often have these conditions caused by viral infections like rotavirus, which causes severe secretory diarrhea, and the virus infects columnar epithelial cells and inhibits absorptive capacity of these cells, causing a net secretion of water and salt, and giving rise to the watery diarrhea. So it could be both bacteria or viruses. And of course, the argument here is, well, we're always exposed to these potential pathogens out there in the world in which we live. So how do we keep a healthy gut at all? And that's a consequence of the gut mucosal lymphoid tissue effects, the immune system of the gut. Someone once asked me, why is it that more than 50% of the immune system of the body is clustered around the intestinal tract? Of course, I never really got direct pipeline of divination on understanding that, but my logic, and I think that which most people use teleologically, is that the gut mucosa is so rich in immune function because over the course of living, we will be exposed to nearly 20 tons of foreign molecules in what we eat. We're not cannibals. We don't eat molecules of the same type that we're made up of. So we eat these foreign molecules in our food, which then have to be converted into friendly molecules by the digestive process and by immune tagging of them to look like friends. And so the immune system is there to defend us against foreign molecules, against foreign critters. As you know, the second largest organ in mass in the body is that really of the GI enteric bacteria. Something like almost up to 2 kilograms of bacteria are living within the human GI tract, and these organisms are producing the results of their own metabolism, their waste products, exhibiting their own personality. So our gut mucosal immune system has a responsibility for managing all of that. So it's quite a task. So that probably explains why we have so much of our immune system clustered around our gut through the gut-associated lymphoid tissue and the mucosal-associated lymphoid tissue. All of these are there, again, to help protect against injury to the gut mucosal barrier function. So when we think about this barrier function, I think we have to also recognize that it's not only microorganisms, but it can also be molecules that can induce injury to the mucosa. These could be termed allergens. Inert entities such as allergens are known to affect barrier function. If one considers the immune system is normally in a luminal compartment, that's a fluid compartment opposite the lumen in nearly all cases for epithelial system, and environmental allergens then contact the organism through its luminal compartments, like, for instance, nasal airways or bronchi and GI mucosal lumens, allergens will not cause an inflammatory response, the source of their bad reputation, unless they gain access to the interstitial compartment on the other side of the barrier. So there has to be some type of breakdown of the mucosal epithelium of the nasal airways, the bronchi, or the GI mucosa for that allergy response really to result. So again, we think of exposure to something as triggering an allergy, but it's exposure leading to mucosal breakdown, leading to then the effects on the immune system. In instances of chronic allergic rhinitis, for instance, nasal mucosa has exhibited not only desquamation of the epithelium, but also increased permeability of epithelial junctions. Dust mite allergens, for instance, have been found to possess several proteolytic enzymes actually capable of causing progressive breakdown of the mucosal barriers. They actually have a stealth system to break down our defensive system, allowing entry then of these antigens to the immune system. These proteases are both cysteine and serine specific, and they lead to well-known cleavage sites within the mucosa and then kind of open the portals of entry to getting access to the immune system. So the immune system, obviously, once activated, then we start thinking about inflammation. And when one thinks about the immune system from a compartmental or barrier point of view, it is striking that the immune system is often an endothelial or an epithelial barrier away from the action source itself, that downstream, ultimately, the inflammation occurs from the upstream breakdown of the mucosal barrier. Microorganisms normally first enter the body by colonizing luminal compartments simply because these compartments have the most contact with their environment. If there is a dysfunctional relationship between this bacteria on the mucosal surface, then it kind of engages the enemy and ultimately can lead to the breakdown of the mucosal surface, again, exposing the immune system to the debris or the secondary metabolites, and that then activates the immune system. And although the changes may be seen locally with rubor, choler, or dolor, the redness, hotness, heat, and inflammation, they can have systemic effects because the immune system is on alarm, and these processes are not just isolated in one tissue. They can travel through the bloodstream, through the activation of things like tumor necrosis factor alpha or interferon gamma or interleukin 1 or interleukin 2, the pro-inflammatory cytokines. So we now start getting an activation of the immune system and potential systemic effects. It's very important to recognize that breakdowns in barrier function and activation of the immune system can be associated with a state of chronic inflammation, which produces effects on all sorts of different tissues. And with few exceptions, there is known to be then the expression of a barrier function alteration associated with these chronic inflammatory conditions. The question you might ask is, well, does the inflammation cause a barrier function breakdown, or does the barrier function breakdown cause inflammation? And the answer is yes. It's both. It's really a cycle. It's a chicken and the egg, and they're all part of the hen. You can come into that from either perspectives. An inflammatory process can trigger a breakdown, or a breakdown can trigger, due to immune upregulation, can trigger inflammation. So we're starting to see things like, for instance, diseases that were previously not considered very tightly associated with breakdowns of barrier function, now having maybe early etiological connection to breakdown of barrier function. Things like coronary artery disease, where we now see arterial endothelial cell dysfunction and loss of barrier function on the endothelium, initiating then aspects of the pathophysiology that leads to the atherogenesis. Secondly, we think about inflammatory bowel disease or Crohn's disease. We also think about certain types of colonic cancer relative risks associated with these gut mucosal barrier dysfunctions and inflammation that leads to alteration in gene expression patterns, oncogene mutagenesis, and ultimately cancer. So a whole variety of different conditions may come out of this across different diagnostic profiles and different medical specialties. So there's really no organ left behind. As we know, the function of the gut mucosa is dependent on its cellular constituents as well as its assembly into a cohesive unit. The developing gut faces unique challenges as one of the longest and largest organs in the body, and also because it is constantly interfacing with external factors through the diet. As I mentioned, nearly 20 tons of foreign molecules will eat in the course of a lifetime. Our gut mucosa has to translate the friend from foe. It has to abstract the nutrients and reject all these toxins over the course of your living. Its location of the GI mucosa deep within the body has until recently hampered investigation, but recently now the patterning of the gut along its longitudinal and radial axes is one of the most fascinating issues that pertain to the development, function, and homeostasis of the GI organ. And in fact, gastroenterology is undergoing a tremendous revolution in thinking, because it's now being seen that the GI system is really a messenger system to the rest of the body through not only the barrier function, but through the gut immune system and all the various tropic effects and mediators that are produced by the gut, even things that trigger functions in the brain leading to satiety, or things that trigger functions to other members of the endocrine system that causes secretion downstream. So the gut may be a very important translator of external stimuli into systemic functional changes. This was beautifully described in a recent series of articles that appeared within Science magazine entitled The Inner Tube of Life. I think that probably describes the gut function very well, the inner tube of life. These occurred in the March 25, 2005 issue of Science, Volume 307, and I think you'll find these articles really quite informative, because it paints the picture of the gut as this dynamic functional organ that's more than just a tube. It's a very important part of the signaling system and the immune regulation of the body that has effects on distant sites, other medical specialties, so to speak. What about self-renewal of the gut mucosa? I think you probably know that the intestinal epithelium represents this exquisite model for the study of really stem cell biology, because the gut mucosa is constantly having to regenerate itself. It is likely the simplest mammalian study model for tissue self-renewal, yet it features multipotent stem cells, amplifying compartments, several lineage decisions that require within these cells to create daughter cells that are of the same integrity as the parent cells. The function of the mammalian intestinal epithelial then possesses formidable challenges by being able to maintain integrity after exposure to toxic things in the environment, be either the skin as epithelium or the gut mucosa being exposed to its contents. And as you know, the anatomy of the small intestinal epithelium really, if you think about structure and function being tied together, shows this tremendous evolutionary adaptation through natural selection to functionally be able to manifest those, that balance between being a barrier protective function and being a dynamic organ. The microvilli with their cells embedded, the crypt villus junction, then allows the cells to have these personalities of both defense and transport. So the goblet cells, the intracrine cells, and the absorptive epithelial cells, which are all derived out of stem cells in the gut mucosa, then are re-differentiated upon the gut mucosal turnover probably every 7 to 10 days. And so there's this constant shedding and reformation of your gut mucosa, just as there is on our skin, but maybe even more dynamically in the gut mucosa. So if you think of what happens in a case of malnutrition or high stress, these rapid turnover tissues that have high tissue specificity and embryological development may be those that are most rapidly affected by temporal undernutrition, malnutrition, or stress. That's often what happens, doesn't it? We all know this, and people who are under stress or not eating right, is the first signs that they experience are those in their GI mucosa, often happen in the mouth, right? You get canker sores, your tongue changes texture, you have your lips start getting chapped, you get chylosis at the corner of your mouth. These tissues that are the rapid turnover tissues start to be reflective of the stresses of life and the undernutrition. We often look in a nutritional assessment at those tissues, at the first signs. We have a person stick out their tongue to see if they have geographic tongue or hairy tongue or dark tongue, or whether they have poor color in their tongue, or we look at their lips, or we look at their gums, we look at their gingivitis, we look at the mucosa in their oral cavity. All of these are indicative of what's going on. This is the lining of the surface. So we can't look at the lung epithelium, pulmonary epithelium, or the GI mucosal epithelium as easily as we can look in the mouth. So we often use that as our indirect or surrogate assessment tool for evaluating barrier function. And you know that B vitamins, for instance, play a big role in helping to prevent injuries to our mucosa in our tongue and the epithelium in our mouth. And so you say, why B vitamins? Because B vitamins are so important in the energy processing systems of the body. And recall what I said in the introduction is that when our energy processing systems, our mitochondrial oxidative phosphorylation, our Krebs cycle activities are compromised, what happens is your barrier function, rapid turnover cells, then can't get the proper energy necessary for their regeneration. I'm using kind of broad brush language here, but this is really the underpinning of what leads to the bleeding gums of scurvy or the various things that we see with thiamine deficiency with beriberi in the oral cavity. So when we start really getting into a discussion of how molecular metabolic function connects to whole organism observations, one of the signs and symptoms that we see are related to these breakdown in epithelial function. What about this host bacterial mutualism in the human intestine? Because clearly part of our relationship we have over the course of our living, starting really with the first moments of life after delivery, is the inoculation of our GI tract with bacteria. The distal human intestine, you know, represents an anaerobic bioreactor, and it's producing secondary metabolites from these fecal bacteria that live within the lower southern hemisphere portions of our GI tract, principally in the colon, but they can obviously find their way up into the rest of the small intestine, even as far up as the esophagus and into the oral cavity in people who have very deranged GI mucosal function or immune function, like in individuals on immunosuppressive drugs or individuals who have been taking very strong chemotherapy. We will often find the disturbed bacterial dysregulation, which then leads to what's called small bowel proliferation or even into the esophagus. So with this in mind, we recognize that the bacteria don't necessarily have one place they are to stay. If you get a change in the GI pH, you get a change in peristaltic action, you get a change in electrolytes, a change in immune function within the gut, these bacteria can travel up through various junctions and be seen throughout the whole of the GI tract so that you now have the risk of bacterial overgrowth and breakdown of barrier function and what we call leaky gut that can be in the small intestine. The distal human intestine, however, as we said, is where most of this microbiological activity occurs. It's anaerobic in nature. These organisms are fermenting various substrates, so we call it a bioreactor. They're producing their own secondary metabolites, and they have an enormous effect then on the activity of the immune function of the gut. if you get a lot of gram-negative bacterial overgrowth and death, these release things like lipopolysaccharides. These lipopolysaccharides then go on to be very powerful immune-activating agents that can produce, in severe cases, things like septic shock, hypovolemia, activation of immune system, nitric oxide output with vasorelaxation, and low blood pressure and hypotensive death. That's the extreme case. In the more mild cases, however, chronic imbalances, you get these symptoms that are more diffuse and hard to understand of feeling crummy, as Dr. Robert Sapolsky talked about. Now, there's many organisms in our gut that play important roles in helping to defend against the parasitic organisms. And in fact, there's now evidence that even those organisms that we might have said were parasitic are mutually beneficial at low levels, like H. pylori. You know, H. pylori, is due to Barry Marshall's work, has been tagged with a reputation of being a toxic organism leading to peptic ulcer disease. But there's now very strong evidence to indicate that some level of H. pylori may be considered desirable as a commensal or maybe even symbiote, because it helps to defend against esophageal cancer and it helps to defend against esophageal inflammatory injury and breakdown. And in fact, there's a wonderful review paper that just appeared in the February 2005 issue of Scientific American entitled An Endangered Species in the Stomach, The Decline of H. pylori. And what they point out in this article is that colonization of H. pylori may increase the risk of stomach diseases, but it protects against esophageal disorders. So there's some kind of maybe a balance between the two that's very important. So if you completely eradicated H. pylori, yes, you might lower the risk to a peptic ulcer disease and stomach cancer, but only increase the risk of Barrett's esophagus, adenocarcinoma of the esophagus, and acid reflux disease, which seems to be associated more prevalently with the absence of H. pylori than in its presence. What we're really suggesting is that we should be a little bit mindful not to too quickly tag a bacterium as always bad. It's balance and it's looking at the personality in concert with other bacteria. Eradicating one bacteria in the gut may in fact not always produce the most favorable outcome. How do you then establish proper function of these flora in the gut? Well, one way of doing it clinically, obviously, is the use of probiotics and prebiotics. This is a very important part of functional medicine therapy for gastrointestinally related disorders. And there's a very interesting recent review. There's actually hundreds of these, but one that I think recently describes the important role that probiotics have in modifying both GI and systemic disease risk appeared in Journal of Nutrition, volume 135, page 1294 in 2005. And this is a review that talks about probiotics, these live bacterial cultures that we consume that are documented to survive through the GI mucosal digestive process and ultimately can have anti-inflammatory, anti-diarrheal, and anti-allergic effects both in infant, children, and adults, and help to balance the immunological function, the so-called thymus-dependent 1 and thymus-dependent 2 immunological function. I would say one of the greatest tools in GI medicine for simple therapeutics is the use of probiotics and prebiotics. Prebiotics are the selective food to feed these friendly bacteria, the Lactobacillus acidophilus or the bifidobacteria. There are things like arabinogalactans or fructans or fructose oligosaccharides. These are specific substrates upon which these friendly bacteria can ferment and proliferate, producing as a secondary byproduct butyrate in the colon. And butyrate, as you know, enhances the defense of the GI immune system. And so butyrate production in situ is a very important part of immune defense in the gut and can be improved through the consumption of prebiotics and probiotics, helping to maintain proper gut mucosal integrity and metabolism. By the way, this is discussed in a recent issue of the journal Carcinogenesis, volume 26, page 1064 in 2005. So certainly prebiotics and probiotics are important therapeutic tools and become part of what in functional medicine we call our 4R program. And some of you know those R's. Those 4R's stand for remove, replace, reinoculate, which is where the pro and prebiotics occur, and then lastly, repair. Repair is the use of things like pantothenic acid, L-arginine, L-glutamine, and zinc in a non-irritating form to improve gut mucosal integrity. Let's, if we can, move on to the next part of this discussion with our clinician of the month. Well, once again, we're at that place in Functional Medicine Update each month that I know we look forward to, and that's with our clinician or researcher of the month. We're lucky to have someone who represents really both of those characteristics, Dr. Kenneth D. Fine. Dr. Fine is a gastroenterologist, did his medical education at the University of Missouri, the Kansas City School of Medicine, and his postgraduate training in gastroenterology and internal medicine at Baylor University, and then was
later on the faculty at Baylor and was actively involved in what I would call, from my bias, obviously, functional gastroenterological research, or let's just call it gastroenterological research, from both the clinical and experimental side. He's now the medical director and director of operations for Intro Lab, a reference lab in the area of GI assessment that we'll be talking about. But I think Dr. Fine brings a very rich background of experience in the area that's what I would call the sweet spot for functional medicine, and that is the role that the gut has in modifying or modulating functions systemically and interrelationship between the GI function and the liver function and how that can influence other inflammatory functions throughout the body. We welcome you to Functional Medicine Update, Dr. Fine. What led you in your area, especially into studying diarrheal disorders and moving on from there to so many areas that relate to functional gastroenterology?
Well, first of all, I'd like to thank you for having me on your tape program today. It is a great honor to tell you the stories of my past research and where I think it's going. My original interest started early in medical school with an interest in nutrition. And obviously, the intestine is the conduit for all of our nutrients of the body for the most part. And it was really my desire to be at the best institution and work with the best researcher that I was aware of at the time, and this was out of medical school, Dr. John Fortran. And so that led me to Baylor University Medical Center to do my internal medicine residency and then did a 3-year fellowship with him. And he obviously has been the pioneer and really the world's expert in both diarrheal diseases and intestinal physiology for decades, and he's still active there. And so it was really my association at that institution being, I sometimes even call it a quaternary referral center. When the tertiary referral centers can't come up with diagnoses for chronic diarrheal disorders and very complicated inflammatory disorders of the bowel, they would be referred to Baylor, and that would be from all over the world, obviously. And I was fortunate enough to come under his mentoring and upbringing to the point where I was eventually not only had my own research program and in my specific areas that eventually became the microscopic colitis form of colitis as well as celiac disease and gluten sensitivity, but while I worked with him, it was really more general in the area of diarrheal disease. Well, I was the laboratory director of the specialized laboratory for functional and diagnostic testing. We called it the GI Physiology Laboratory. So it was really that background and being at that institution and working with a great researcher and Dr. Fortran that led me to all of my present positions today.
Well, that's a tremendous background, obviously, and I'm sure you got everyone's attention now because when an expert speaks, people listen. So let's go from there into an area that you have published highly on, which is the area of chronic diarrhea and what are the various causes and the diagnoses. So maybe you can give us from the mouth of an expert, I know this is a big topic, but maybe a summary of how one differentiates the causes of chronic diarrhea.
Well, obviously, differentiating acute diarrhea from chronic diarrhea is very important because most of the causes of acute diarrhea are usually some infectious contact or short-lived exposure to a medication or supplement that might be new. But once diarrhea progresses beyond 4 to 6 weeks, we usually differentiate it as being chronic. And then there are some very simple things that should be done, and they're usually diagnostic tests that can differentiate the different causes and possibly the different routes of diagnostic evaluation to take. And again, we always say in my field, the proof is in the pudding, and therefore, fecal analysis is of paramount importance in assessment of not only diarrheal disease, but probably all GI disease. Whether there's inflammatory cells or derivatives of inflammatory cells, such as lactoferrin, which is the test we've kind of pioneered in the stool, looking at inflammatory causes, we can use a very simple analysis of fecal sodium and potassium to determine if osmotic diarrhea is present. And that's always caused by ingestion of some osmotically active agent that dilutes sodium and potassium concentrations to a point where it's mainly the presence of some other osmotic factor. Magnesium was one we've published on where we found that 4% of people referred to our quaternary referral center were actually either having chronic diarrhea from magnesium supplements or an now and then it'll even be what we've called surreptitious laxative abuse, where a patient's actually taking laxatives. It's kind of a psychiatric disorder. And then there's also the fecal fat analysis. Again, if someone's having malabsorption, that puts it into a totally different category of disease, separate from others that you would take a different approach. And that's how we've settled into the area of fecal analysis, is really the best service we can give both to clinical practitioners, referral laboratories, and the public, that there's so much to be learned from some simple analyses. And then, of course, we have since found how frequent food sensitivity, particularly gluten sensitivity, can be even in something as purely as chronic diarrhea.
I know that at least in a couple of your publications, one in the journal Gastroenterology in 1999 and the other in Intestinal Endoscopy in 2000, you talk about how one might look at the major etiological agents associated with chronic diarrhea. If you were to, from your clinical experience, evaluate those, how would they rank 1, 2, 3 in terms of the precipitating triggers for chronic diarrhea? Are there things that you see, like you mentioned, the magnesium being in maybe 4 to 5%? How would you rate those precipitating causes?
Well, actually, it depends most on the clinical setting. The more refractory and or the more difficult in diagnosing a problem, then that list changes. But generally, inflammatory disorders, Crohn's disease, you know, microscopic colitis we found accounts for as much as 50% of chronic diarrhea at the tertiary referral stage, although anymore it's better known, and so biopsies have become a standard part of colonoscopic evaluation. Before that was known to do, then people would be missed because the mucosa looked normal. It comes down to what setting you're in. The main causes are inflammatory bowel disease, ingestion of some agent that's causing chronic diarrhea, or sometimes it's just the food sensitivity that we've talked about. Even our understanding of the magnitude of the problem is growing, with 50% of people with irritable bowel syndrome now being found to be gluten sensitive if you actually look inside the intestine, either with genital aspiration or with our testing, fecal testing. I really think it comes down, trying to think of it in the ways that your institute does, the function, what's the functional cause. It mostly comes down to food and flora. It's well known now that almost all chronic inflammatory disorders of the gut are directed at either the food or the flora in the gut. And there are many animal models of chronic inflammatory bowel disease. Simply introducing a greater number of Bacteroides species rather than Lactobacillus species, or a chemical insult, will then lead to attack of the normal flora that becomes now immunogenic and loss of immune tolerance. And so suddenly you have colitis rather than no reaction to all those bacteria at all. And then I want to mention the widespread use of non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, which obviously impair the mucosal barrier, the permeability barrier of the gut. And those are a pretty common cause of GI problems, whether it be ulcers at the top and inflammation at the bottom.
Before we go into greater detail on this very fascinating gluten connection, I want to just follow on with one of the comments that you made, and that is there any evidence that certain types of IBS are precursors into IBD and or microscopic colitis, or are these really two separate disorders that don't have an interrelationship?
I would say they sound more similar when you use the acronyms than probably they really are. IBD, inflammatory bowel disease, which typically is Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis, and now microscopic colitis really should be in that category also. But those really are inflammatory disorders directed either at a flora that has changed in such a way where there's not enough protective, quote-unquote, good bacteria to keep the genes that are probably hypersensitive to gut stimulation from reacting. Or, again, it should be mentioned that the diagnostic test for Crohn's disease has now been found to be a serum test against dietary yeast, Saccharomyces cerevisiae. And that itself may play a large role in causing these inflammatory disorders. But IBS, irritable bowel syndrome, is really a separate disorder that to some extent has a different epidemiology and is really more of what seems to be a, we call it functional bowel disease, but what that's really boiling down to mean is that to a large extent the neurologic function is abnormal. Either the motility is low and therefore causes more bloating symptoms, allows bacterial overgrowth to occur as a secondary phenomenon, or there's also a hypersensitivity of the neuroafferent stimuli that they respond and sense greater pain at smaller stimuli, such as a smaller pressure and size of distension of the intestine. So I would really look at those separately. I would say there is a common denominator in that I believe in both disorders, food sensitivity does play a role, and it's always been known that people with inflammatory bowel disease have a pretty high, more than double the frequency, really almost triple the frequency of serum antibodies to gliadin and to some extent milk proteins than normal people do, and it's always been either cast off as a false negative or maybe something secondary to the abnormal permeability. But when you think about the abnormal function of abnormal mucosal protection and permeability, then more exposure to food antigens and bacterial antigens leading to an inflammatory response really should be paid attention to and not cast off. So that's how I would boil those down.
That's very helpful. And let's move from there then into the other topic that you alluded to, and that's assessment. And I know that you've been very actively involved in looking at different assessment tools and developing different assessment tools. An American Journal of Gastroenterology article that you authored in 1998 talking about, as you mentioned, lactoferrin and neutrophil protein lactoferrin for assessing inflammatory causes of chronic diarrhea. And you mentioned also other tests that could be done out of the stool. So to the clinician, how would they approach this diagnostically in working up the patient to do the evaluation?
And I should say before I start is that once I began as the director of the GI Physiology Laboratory at Baylor University Medical Center, which I was hired really to improve the service and the methodology and such, being young at that time and seeing most of these tests really being of yesteryear, and to some extent some of the tests in GI analysis are still decades old. In fact, doing intestinal biopsies for celiac sprue or 72-hour fecal fat studies, I mean, these are things that came out of the 50s for biopsies and the 40s for 72-hour fecal fat, which, interestingly, I think of historic note, that was originally a test of intestinal function of celiac patients. And it was developed by the biochemist who worked with the Dutch pediatrician Willem Dicke, who actually discovered the link between gluten and celiac disease. So it was really my goal to see what could be done to make diagnostic testing easier on the patient, easier on the clinician, and of course easier on the laboratory. Because, you know, if you've ever seen a laboratory filled with buckets of stool, you'd appreciate the fact that anything that could reduce the volume and numbers of 72-hour collections is obviously favorable to everybody. And so one of the first things we did was, in addition to applying an existing test for inflammation, you know, we've all heard of fecal white cells. That was the standard for inflammation. But because these tests over the years have been done less frequently than in the past, the laboratory technicians themselves, because they're operator dependent, became kind of less and less skilled. Plus, the test itself has its own variability because of trying to find white cells floating in the fecal water. So we applied a test developed by a company primarily to detect acute diarrhea and try to differentiate acute bacterial infectious causes of diarrhea from mostly viral and other causes of acute diarrhea by the presence of fecal white cells. We applied that to the chronic diarrheal states and found that for the most part in chronic diarrhea, if there's evidence of fecal neutrophils, which in case of our test is a lactoferrin test, then that almost always is either in Crohn's disease or ulcerative colitis. And because the test offers a semi-quantitative analysis of the severity of the inflammation, if it's 2 or 3 plus rather than 1 plus, then it's always one of those two disorders. And microscopic colitis being more of a T-cell infiltrative disease with rare neutrophils, most cases are going to be negative, but sometimes there are enough neutrophils to be positive, but they'll always be of the 1 plus lower quantitative assessment of the amount of inflammation. And then, of course, if there's no inflammation, it pretty much rules out active colitis, either of the Crohn's or ulcerative colitis or any cause of mucosal disruption. Microscopic colitis is different because, you know, it has basically the integrity of the mucosa remains intact, and we're still looking at other potential fecal tests to hopefully be able to diagnose that without having to go to biopsy. But the next test that I think is of paramount importance is the fecal fat test. And you have to get away outside of these quaternary and possibly tertiary referral centers. You got to get away from 72-hour collections because they're somewhat impractical. They're so dependent on collection because the output is really calculated from the measured fat concentration multiplied by the total collection, somewhat like a 24-hour urine collection. And if there's any collection misses at all, then the analysis is going to be falsely negative. So we were able to improve upon the old qualitative microscopic fecal fat analysis by Sudan stain testing, and we developed a quantitative analysis that perfectly linearly correlated with 72-hour collections, and this was published in, I think it was the American Journal of Clinical Pathology in 2000, basically showing that one stool with this quantitative fat analysis could determine with a numeric expression whether someone had malabsorption or not, and then that could be followed over treatment to see if there was improvement. So those are two tests that must be applied. And again, what we call a fecal osmotic gap, which requires a fecal sodium and potassium, that can easily differentiate osmotic diarrhea from some ingested agent. Truthfully, if it's going to be magnesium, and that we found is the most commonly ingested osmotic agent in causing diarrhea, a lot of times just asking the patient, are you taking antacids? Are you taking vitamins and possibly mineral supplements, as common as they are today? And, you know, I actually was a magnesium researcher, not only of diarrhea, but also magnesium absorption. So a lot of times I'll look at supplements containing magnesium, and actually the dosing of magnesium in most supplements is excessive to the point where more than half of the magnesium will be malabsorbed. And if they take it more than once a day, then there may be enough to even cause chronic diarrhea. So those are the three initial tests. I also published a study showing that in the assessment of chronic diarrhea, if there is going to be an endoscopic procedure, that it does not have to be a full colonoscopy, but that the shorter and less invasive and not requiring sedation, flexible sigmoidoscopy, the 60-centimeter flex sig with biopsies is adequate. And if that's normal, then you can essentially rule out microscopic colitis as long as your fecal lactoferrin is negative, and you've also ruled out Crohn's colitis and ulcerative colitis. So those are probably the simple things, but of course I cannot speak of this subject without mentioning the importance of this fecal anti-gliadin antibody, which is the test for gluten sensitivity, which turns out in the most exclusive of patient populations, those that all of the other disorders tend to be diagnosed, may account for as much as 50% of chronic diarrhea.
Well, that's a wonderful segue. That's exactly where I hoped we were going to go next, because I really was very impressed with your paper in the American Journal of Gastroenterology in 201 looking at celiac sprue and its association with autoimmune liver disease, and also your American Journal of Gastroenterology paper in 2000 on the high prevalency of celiac sprue in people that have certain HLA-DQ gene polymorphisms. I found that when you started looking at things like anti-endomysial antibodies and anti-tissue transglutaminase antibodies and correlating that then with dietary gluten and small intestinal pathology, that it looks to me like there is an emerging recognition of what some people have said is present for some time, but has been kind of rejected by traditional gastroenterology, that this concept of gluten immune sensitization is more prevalent than we previously thought. It sounds like that's where your work is taking us.
Yeah, and I have to say that it was indeed that paper, the one that you mentioned, the celiac-like genes and even the small intestinal pathology in patients with microscopic colitis, that really kicked the door wide open on this whole field, so much to me that I could feel the importance so much that I felt obligated to bring this research and the fruits and the ability to do these diagnostic tests to the public directly. And that's how I kind of ended up on a career of public service rather than a traditional academic medical career. But what we knew was that in using microscopic colitis as the exemplary chronic inflammatory, I can't call it autoimmune because we don't necessarily know that it's autoimmune, but if it's anything like the other autoimmune diseases, it's a chronic inflammatory disease with T helper cell mediated chronic inflammatory response. And what we saw when looking at the HLA genetics, that 64% actually had the HLA-DQ2 gene that is normally highly associated with celiac disease. 90 to 95% of American celiacs actually have an HLA-DQ2 gene. So we always tend to think of it as the celiac gene, and at least it is known that the gene product of that gene does indeed bind gliadin and presents it to the immune system as an antigen presentation. And so if you have that gene, then you are binding gliadin in your gut and presenting it to your gut-associated mucosal system as an antigen, and what reaction you get from there is under further genetic control, environmental control, and a lot of other factors, both intraluminal to the gut as well as external, possibly environmental factors. But we saw there were patients who had this microscopic colitis, which under the microscope, by the way, and this was another clue to me, under the microscope, microscopic colitis actually looks like a total villous atrophic lesion of the small intestine. Now, the colon, there are no villi like there are in the small intestine, but when you have celiac disease, all of those villi go away, in the worst cases, total villous atrophy, and then what you're left with is a chronically inflamed, flat mucosa with an abnormal surface epithelium infiltrated in the surface epithelium with T cells, which we call intraepithelial lymphocytes, as well as plasma cells and lymphocytes in the lamina propria. And so we've got a histologic lesion that smells like, if you will, celiac disease. We've got a genetic propensity of the celiac genes in this disorder. And yet, if you look at serologic assessment of anti-gliadin and anti-endomycial or tissue transglutaminase antibodies, you do not see any greater expression of those in the serum of those patients than you do in a normal population. Although it should be mentioned that even in a normal population, 10 to 12% of people will have anti-gliadin antibody in their serum. So already we know that there's, you know, 10% of quote-unquote the normal American population is walking around with an antibody in their blood to gliadin. And so it kind of dawned on me based on, there were two lines of research, past research, really three perhaps, that led me to my search for an antibody in stool. And the first was these published studies of gluten-sensitive patients who did not have villous atrophy. And the very first was published in 1980, and it was simply titled Gluten-Sensitive Diarrhea, where they had 8 patients with chronic diarrhea, everything else seemed normal. They did a very detailed analysis, small intestinal pathology, and although there was no villous atrophy and there was really no significant chronic inflammation that they would have been called inflamed, when they did some sophisticated counting techniques, they found that there really were more plasma cells than not, and that these patients responded to a gluten-free diet, and these were diagnosed in a celiac center, so they obviously had a focus on that potential. And then there were subsequent studies in 96 and 2001, one of which looked at irritable bowel syndrome patients where they actually did a small intestinal aspiration and found anti-gliadin and even anti-casein, the milk protein antibodies inside the intestine along with the DQ2 gene, and those patients too got better on a gluten-free diet. And then there was yet a third study, and I take my hat off to this group because they're still following this line of research, and we're kind of following similar lines of research where I'm doing fecal testing, and their initial study of taking intestinal biopsies and putting them in vitro with gluten and finding that suddenly those otherwise normal appearing mucosal biopsies would start to express more of the HLA antigens as well as produce anti-endomycial antibody in the fluid of the petri dish. And so what we have now is the knowledge that you do not have to have villous atrophy for your intestine to react to gliadin, and that you get better on a gluten-free diet. And that's what all of these studies showed. And there was even a fourth one out of Finland in 2001. So that was one line of research. And then the other line of research was the fact that serologic tests were not finding all of the people with celiac disease, especially if they had anything less than total villous atrophy. And there were a couple of studies. One of them was out of England, and the other one was out of the Netherlands. And what they found was that only 31% of celiacs that have partial villous atrophy, not total villous atrophy, so only 31% actually had serologic positivity of either anti-gliadin or endomycial antibodies. And so when I took that piece of information back to my microscopic colitis population, none of which had total villous atrophy, and almost all of them either had minimally expressed inflammation of the small intestine, I got the idea, well, maybe they're like celiacs who don't get villous atrophy and do not get serologic positivity. And so it was borrowing from a third line of research that was done over a 30-year period by Dr. Ann Ferguson. She also was in England, who did a procedure. It was basically an intestinal lavage where they would wash out the gut contents and measure the effluent for anti-gliadin IgA and IgM. And she always called a celiac-like pattern of anti-gliadin antibody that you could actually have more anti-gliadin antibody in your intestine than normal, much like a celiac, which is why they used the term celiac-like, and we used it too in our research, but that you did not have villous atrophy. And they always thought that those people were latent celiacs, meaning that at some future point you'd become a celiac. Well, so we extended on her research, obviously doing an intestinal lavage on everybody to be assessed for gluten sensitivity is not practical. And why no one did it before us in the stool, I can't say. I have to think maybe it's just because laboratories and personnel tend to be a little phobic about stool, but the fact that I had my upbringing in that field, it was certainly no issue for us. And lo and behold, we found about 75% of patients with microscopic colitis, 50% of people with chronic diarrhea. As a control group, we found 100% of people with untreated celiac sprue had these antibodies in their stool, whereas even in celiac disease, overall, there's only about a 75% positivity of these antibodies in the blood. So that's really how that presented itself, and I have to say that we haven't turned back from that fact once we realized that not only are a large number of people with diseases, but that about 2.5 times the number of people with anti-gliadin antibody in their serum can be found to have this in their intestine, which is the precursor, obviously, of getting some expression of that either as a disease or eventually as a serologic antibody.
I want to really compliment you. That is a very technically complicated story, and you've done just a marvelous job of condensing it down into understandable components. And for our listeners, I hope they're going to go back and listen to this discussion several times, because I think there are so many positive, incredible things buried in what you just discussed. The fact that serology may not be the sine qua non for picking these gluten sensitivity relationships up, the fact that there is this functional continuum of sensitivity all the way from what we would consider the kind of traditional sprue to these flu-like conditions, and that kind of really marries itself to the whole functional medicine concept, and then to the looking at the various parameters in the stool that interrelate various sensitivities in the diet to these functional diarrheal disorders. I think you've really painted a magnificent picture, and I can see why you've taken your discoveries into the general public. And for our listeners, more information about what Dr. Fine is talking about, the tests that he developed, can be found on his website, which is www.enterolab, that's enterolab.com, and that's a very nice discussion of the history and the diagnostic usefulness of the test. So, Dr. Fine, I want to really thank you. I wish we had much more time. This has been extraordinarily interesting for me, but again, we're going to put a bibliography of reading of your references and publications, and I'm sure people will be checking in and having more discussion with you. You've opened up our eyes, I think, to a whole other chapter of functional gastroenterology.
Thank you very much, and my staff and I and the website, and I have my own not-for-profit institute called the Intestinal Health Institute. We are really devoted to improved intestinal and overall health and ultimately greater health, happiness, and hope for, you know, our entire public health system and population. We are very supportive not only of the clinicians, but the patients themselves, people. I like to help people before they become patients, but if they're already ailing, we are of service to them directly in our website. There's lectures for physicians. The research to date is published there. There's a long essay on the whole story, basically is a transcript of a talk that I've given, and then we answer all questions by email from any doctors or patrons that have interest, and we are just here to be of service and like I said, to help the intestinal and overall health.
Thank you very much, and we'll be back and check in with you, and thanks for spending the time with us today.
What we've learned is that the gut mucosa as an epithelial barrier defense is exposed to allergens and to toxins and to parasites, all of which can activate the immune system, leading to inflammation or allergy, and that can then create barrier function breakdown, leaky membranes through transcellular or paracellular transport, and ultimately have systemic effects. So the gut immune system has a challenge, obviously, of responding to these pathogens while remaining relatively unresponsive to other food materials. That leads to what's sometimes called tolerance, that when we get the proper immune function going in the gut starting early in life, that we have tolerance to certain molecules and intolerance to other exposures. One of the reasons why you don't want to expose an infant too early to potentially antigenic substances is you may lose this tolerance effect and actually produce an inflammatory memory in certain T cells that then sets that child up to become allergic throughout much of their life to those materials. So you don't want to give them cow's milk too early or feed them a lot of wheat-based products too early before their immune system of the gut is fully developed and can develop this tolerance. We know that bacteria in the gut play a very important role in maintaining this epithelial immune balance. And so inappropriate bacteria, we've said, or inappropriate microorganisms can upset that balance and alter the thymus-dependent 1, thymus-dependent 2 activity. We recognize, obviously, that the use of probiotics and prebiotics are very important for restoring proper immunological function in a compromised gut. We also recognize removing antigens, allergens, toxins, and parasitic organisms may be very important. And there may be times, obviously, where antibiotic therapy is necessary to sterilize the bowel so you can re-inoculate with friendly critters and reduce the load of potential antigenic substances. One of the other therapeutic tools that is very important in this area are the omega-3 fatty acids, and this is another in the long list of potential applications of omega-3 fatty acids. A recent paper that appeared in the Journal of Parenteral and Enteral Nutrition, which I think is very useful in understanding the connection between omega-3 fatty acids and gut mucosal integrity, this appeared in volume 29, page 236 in 2005, and this was to look at the relationship between omega-3 fatty acids and liver, gut mucosa, and tissue inflammatory functions. And so this was an intervention trial with patients who had various types of operations and were then supplemented with therapeutic diets post-op, and they were given then supplements with fish oil containing EPA and DHA, that's eicosapentaenoic acid, and docosahexaenoic acid. And they were given about 3.7 grams a day of these mixtures of these polyunsaturated fatty acids as fish oil. And they examined then the phospholipid fractions in the plasma on the day of surgery and then after intervention, And then they looked at the various effects that it had on liver function and on gut mucosal function over time. What they found is that the preoperative administration of oral omega-3 fatty acids has an impact on postoperative inflammatory response. Now, this is after a major abdominal surgeries, by lowering the pre-op inflammation in the gut or systemically. So it again demonstrates that omega-3 fatty acids have anti-inflammatory or immune normalizing effects in gut mucosa, even during fairly traumatic times of invasion like you'd have with a GI surgery. We know the omega-3 fatty acids modulate the TH1 and TH2 balance towards lowering inflammation. That's the TH1 dominant type into a more TH2 balanced activity. And this has been actually demonstrated very nicely in a recent study that was published under the title Nutrition Immunology in the Journal of Nutrition, Volume 135, page 1745 in 2004, in which it was shown in a controlled series of studies in animals that fish oil increased the percentage of TH2 polarized cells and suppressed TH1 cell frequency, lowering then these pro-inflammatory mediators that are produced through thymus-dependent 1 lymphocyte activity. We also recognize, obviously, that dietary supplementation of omega-3 fatty acids with folic acid and vitamin B6 and vitamin E has been shown in individuals who have various endothelial vascular injuries to improve their function. This would be in patients with peripheral vascular disease, and we see that they have improved walking distance, lowered pain, and lowered risk factors, which are the inflammatory markers like intercellular adhesion molecule 1 and high sensitivity CRP, after supplementation with the combination of omega-3 fatty acids, folic acid, vitamin B6, and vitamin E. This was a clinical study published recently in the Journal of Nutrition, Volume 135, page 1393 in 2005. These were 60 patients randomly allocated to two groups, by the way. One group got the EPA DHA supplement, which was about a gram a day of a combination EPA DHA, and also supplementation with B6 and vitamin E and folic acid at what we would consider normal nutritional therapeutic levels, not what we would consider mega nutritional levels. So I think that the improvements that was seen in this group after intervention illustrates very clearly that enhanced intake of those nutrients was very helpful. They got, by the way, levels that were in the range of 600 to 800 micrograms of folic acid and about 100 IUs of vitamin E and about 10 milligrams of B6 along with a gram of EPA DHA. And lastly, we know that because all these things are connected together in the web of functional outcome, what we're doing when we improve GI mucosal integrity and function through omega-3 fatty acids, we're improving endothelial function, we're improving hepatobiliary function, we're improving membranous function of the blood-brain barrier, and so we start seeing cardiovascular disease risk being reduced. We see cancer risk being reduced because all of these things are interrelated through this web of life, this homeodynamic balance seen through barrier function, a dynamic activity of membranes. This is discussed, by the way, in the Journal of Medicinal Food, Volume 7, page 387 in 2004. So I hope you've got a sense as to what we're talking about with regard to barrier function and the important role that it plays in defending against toxins and how it is seen as part of our detoxification biotransformation cycle. We'll be exploring these topics in greater detail as we move on towards our 13th International Symposium. Thanks for being with us.
Functional Medicine Update is copyrighted by the Institute for Functional Medicine, located in Gig Harbor, Washington, USA. Reproduction in any form is prohibited.